adapted to quantum space-time. This is based on a series of work done with two of my string collaborators here. But this work has some kind of hybrid origin because this idea of relative locality was also first formulated with collections of work with Liz Molin and Giovanni Amelino Camelia and Jersey. But I'm going to talk mostly about the work I did with Rob Lee and George Minnick here. So let me just summarize a little bit what I'm going to try to say in that talk. The main point is that our concept of space and time, as you know, they have radically evolved over history. A concept of matter too have radically evolved over history. But these developments haven't yet really affected our fundamental picture of space and time. And this is what I want to challenge here. But I'm thinking if I look at the standard model for particle physics and cosmology, we are still having some kind of quantum matter classical space-time. And both of them rely on this notion of usual space and time. So the question is, of course people have tried, but there's not yet a completely accepted, I'm not the first one to worry about that, of course. But in some sense, I'm trying to take a different way from the usual approach. So. One question that we'll be focusing is there a notion of space and time that really organically include quantum mechanics in its fabric? And I'll try to be more precise about how to do that. And first, I want to say, well, I'm not the first one to think about quantum gravity. Of course, we have learned a lot. It's not like we haven't learned nothing about how to put quantum and gravity together. And I want to kind of summarize what I think are the main one of the main aspects of this tremendous experience and progress we have made. What I want to do is maybe go beyond specific quantum gravity models and focus on what somehow unified them instead of focusing on particular simple model. And my take, and I'm going to try to argue that strongly, is really that we need a new physical principle that organizes the next revolution, if you want. And this new physical principle needs to reconcile the relativity principle and the presence of a fundamental scale. That's going to be the point I'm going to try to make. And I'm going to try to propose a principle that I call relative locality, or let's say a sketch of such principle. I'm not saying it's fully developed here, and give it some flesh by discussing what type of geometry it leads to when you really try to make sense of that idea, and how it relates to the geometry of quantum mechanics too. And eventually, I'll go towards giving an example of, which is for me like the Euclidean space type of example, or Minkowski space type of example of relative locality, which we discovered by studying purely just quantum mechanics, but somehow quite remarkably appears also in the study of string theory. So as a worker in quantum gravity, I get often asked the question, why do we care about quantum gravity? Why should I work in that? Some people, a very small fraction, but they really mean there, they say, well, should you even quantize gravity? The answer to them is, of course, we should quantize gravity for the same reason we quantize the electromagnetic field. Gravity is coupled to matter, and matter is quantum. And beyond that, there's also reasons like the presence of singularity of GR, and also evidence from cosmology that some of our large-scale structure comes from quantum fluctuations which are geometrical in nature, which is maybe the first evidence. Now, what really people mean when they ask that question is not that, but what they really mean is that if you believe that quantum gravity is about giving H-bar correction to usual physics, then it makes maybe 30 years, 40 years that we already have a theory of quantum gravity. It's called effective field theory. That is, if you give me a range of energy, and if you give me a level of precision, then you need only to include a finite number of higher order operator, and from there you can make prediction. And for instance, you can compute the corrections to the Newtonian potential, and these are in some sense, you know, in a precise sense, quantum gravity calculation. So so this is really what they have in mind, and I think it's a very serious criticism that I think I subscribe to that. But the reason I continue to believe in quantum gravity is that I do believe that quantum gravity is not just H-bar corrections to the known world. It's a fundamental reformulation of physics, and as such, I expect quantum gravity to come up with radically new phenomena that have no way to express themselves in the realm of effective field theory. So this is what I want to focus on, not just quantum gravity per se and H-bar correction, which is important and interesting subject, because any quantum gravity model which is going to compute H-bar corrections at one loop is going to agree with effectivity theory. And maybe at two loop it might disagree on some observables, but we already know by this kind of computation that this is going to be unmeasurable in practical purpose. Okay, so the hope is that there's something new coming on. And let me expand on that. The idea is that in any breakthrough, any time in history of physics we had a breakthrough, what happened in a breakthrough, which is in some sense the hallmark of a breakthrough, is that new observable, new invisible becomes visible. Okay, and it's very useful to use, I'm going to use the concept of singular limit, which was developed a lot by Michael Berry, to understand this correlation between breakthrough theory and the lower. And it's this idea of Michael Berry is essentially that the lower order description of higher order description of physics is always some kind of singular limit of the more elaborate description. The singular limit has a property to fool yourself perfectly because it's a completely mathematically consistent description of the world, so it doesn't tell you anything about how it's going to become inconsistent with itself. But this description, by essence, cannot reveal certain observables. And here are some. My favorite example is, let's say, perfect fluid versus viscous fluid. No matter how small the viscosity is, a viscous fluid is fundamentally different than a perfect fluid. In a perfect fluid, so the hair is approximately a good perfect fluid, so why not treat it as perfect? Because in perfect fluid, plane can't fly. So when you see a bird in the sky, you know that there's non-zero viscosity. Okay, this is an invisible. Now we know geometrical optics, wave optics. When Fresnel, presented the phenomenon of diffraction, and Poisson told him, this is ridiculous because, if you believe what you're saying, there's going to be a central bright spot, and Arago did the discovery. So no central bright spot. One of my favorite, and I think one of the deepest, is of course Aronofsky phases in quantum mechanics. Like the gauge potential is invisible in any classical way. It becomes visible in quantum mechanics. And of course, relativistic, antiparticles are a famous example of invisible that became visible. And gravity wave, which is that, very recently. So one of the questions, which I think is fruitful to think of if you really want to edge on not just perturbative gravity, but is what are the new invisible that are going to be revealed by quantum gravity? That's a little bit maybe too much for this talk. I think a simpler question, which I'm going to try to give some answer, which is a way towards that answer, is in what sense is today physics the singular limit of something bigger? Okay, and I'm going to make a proposal. Another, let's say, it's going to frame the discussion I'm going to have about, how do we go to the next level, this notion of singular limit invisibles. The next idea, which is a very simple idea, is the idea of unification. We have witnessed in the course of history that any time we had a breakthrough, it was always it was always a fundamental form of unification that took place. Like seemingly opposite concepts, opposite in the original B picture became unified in the more advanced one. And this unification was always encoded in the presence of a universal conversion factor, right? H bar for wave and particle, C for mass and space and time, or mass and energy, energy and information for the Boltzmann constant, and matter and geometry for Newton's constant with C. So clearly, the question that we face, or I think I face, is what's next? Of course, what's next, what kind of unification? And we all kind of feel, okay, clearly it's going to be a deeper unification of quantum geometry, but also more deeply, what kind of unification of the realms we are having? And what I'm going to propose is that it necessarily leads to unifications of the notion of space-time and the notion of energy and momenta. And that's going to be what I'm going to try to argue. So let's go back to what have we learned from quantum gravity. There's many different models of quantum gravity. So if you want to study quantum gravity, one of the things is just to take gravity and quantize it. Of course, perturbatively it doesn't work, but that didn't stop people from trying to pursue it more further, saying, well, maybe, okay, it's non-renormalizable perturbatively, but there's maybe a non-perturbative renormalization point, and they gather evidence that this you know, may be possible. And this is a scenario of asymptotic safety. In this approach, it's just very hard to extract any kind of useful information at this stage. Another idea that has been very popular in loop quantum gravity or spin foam is to say, no, it's not just quantized gravity. Let's somehow quantize geometry. And let's put in the full form background independence and focus on the fact that observables are fundamentally non-local there. In this framework, space is fundamentally discrete. It's built in the Hilbert space spaces. And the challenge in these approaches are, you know, the success is this fundamental discreteness of space, but the challenge is really to reconcile this with the general relativity principle beyond the classical limit where it's done. Now, string theory takes somehow the opposite point of view in the sense that it's not really a study of space-time, it's a study of the probe. And he says, well, okay, let's change the type of probe we use to probe space-time. Let's not probe space-time with particle, but with extended object, and it delocalized the probe. In a way which is consistent with relativity this time, but I think it's fair to say that although there are many hints, it hasn't yet changed, you know, there's no deep understanding of what it is. It doesn't yet change at a deep level our understanding of space and time. And I hope I'll come back to that. And then there are collections, more recently, the focus has been more on emergent model, like let's say causal sets, which you put discreteness and relativity together, or Java gravity, where you say, well, let's not care about Lorentz invariants at all. Okay, let's have a preferred time. And it's a proof of principle that if you don't have Lorentz invariants, you can quantize gravity. Okay, so the challenge is not to quantize gravity. The challenge is to quantize gravity in a way consistent with the relativity principle. Okay, and non-commutative geometry is, and maybe the most fruitful recent idea is a very deep idea about holography, the fact that somehow, you know, gravity has a tendency to delocalize itself and could be reformulated on its boundary for reasons that I may touch on. And then, you know, you get some kind of dual descriptions where you try, the challenge there is to reconstruct the notion of space, time, and locality from computations of correlator. But something, you know, there's something frustrating. So it's a very rich picture. In any sense, all of this approach touch on something really real about the phenomena. But it's frustrating because there's absolutely no sense of convergence or even overlap between this approach. Like, and they're all kind of right and kind of, so you feel like you have to choose, but otherwise one, you know, choosing one means you don't care about what the focus of the other. So, and in none of them yet, there is this, you know, invisible, which is revealed, and this new principle, which is fundamentally revealed, as far as I understand them. So for me, it means maybe we haven't tried everything. Like we need to maybe try to look beyond this, learn from that, but look beyond. So instead of focusing on how different they are, and I studied and I worked on many of them, and I'm trying to, you know, increase my knowledge on any of them, which is something very interesting to do. The question is, I want to focus on what do they have in common? So the only common element that I can find among them is that one way or the other, they introduce a form of non-locality. They all disagree on how this non-locality is introduced, whether it's discreteness or whether it's delocalization on the boundary of ADS-CFT, but it's always there. It's either non-local observable in background independent approach, non-local probes in string theory, non-locality of holography, which is completely delocalized, discreteness, fundamental discreteness, non-locality of the fixed point action. Well, you know, maybe I want to understand a little bit more why it leads to this non-locality. And go back to this statement that after all this, you know, our concept of space and time have not been affected by it. Space and time, they still appear in phi theory as phi of x, the argument of x. It's still this classical space which appear in the label of the C. And it's still a classical concept. Okay, so we want to face non-locality, it seems to me. Any theory of quantum gravity, that's the first point, will involve some form of non-locality. Now the question is, how do we deal with non-locality without opening Pandora's box? The thing is that locality is the reason why we're so successful in our two standard model and GR. You know, it's built in field theory and it's built in general relativity. It's built in everywhere in the assumption, you know, and it's built in also in the way we interpret the theory. It's built in the locality of asymptotic states. It's built in the locality of interactions. It's built in even more deeply into the notion of renormalization group, the fact that there's separations of scale between the infinitely big and infinitely small, and that it can be organized in that way. So these are the foundations of modern physics. These are essentially the organizational principle of effective field theory. So, you know, and if you try to go away from that, you're kind of losing this structure that we understand so perfectly now that we can reconstruct almost from first principle, field theory and gravity, from very unitarity, locality. We understand them really very well. Nima used to say that if you look like three, five good theorists in a room, you know, even without data, now like they would reconstruct from very little principle most of the detail. Okay, we want non-locality, but not any type. Okay, so what is the organizational principle? We need a principle to tame this non-locality. We have to face it, that's step number one, but it cannot just be let go. Let me go back and, because maybe you don't really believe these quantum gravity models, they are models after all based on the idea of theorists. Let's try to go back and see why quantum mechanics, it's things established, like quantum mechanics and GR by themselves have a form of non-locality. And of course, in quantum mechanics, it's well known, there are three forms of non-locality, Heisenberg non-locality, you cannot localize things if you don't have infinite energy, entanglement non-locality, which is a form of kinematical non-locality of entangled states. The one which I'm going to focus on, which is very interesting, is the Aronov-Bohm form of non-locality, which is the non-locality of interferences. And it's a form of dynamical non-locality. I'm going to explain maybe in the next slide what it means. In fact, this is how Aronov came up to this idea of the Aronov-Bohm phase. He just asked a very natural question, what type of observable can measure the interference? Okay, so suppose you have two waves and they have non-overlapping supports, and you want to have access to this phase of interference here, that measure how they're going to interfere. Now, the main remark that they make is that no semi-classical observable will ever detect this phase, no matter how complicated it is. So no polynomial observable will detect this phase. In order to detect this phase, you need to invent a type of observables which is fundamentally non-local and involve an angle. And in order to involve an angle, it has to involve 1/h bar there. It's not an observable that you would even see if you were just computing h-bar corrections to any arbitrary power. It will absolutely never, ever appear. Okay, and these modular operator, because they are angle operator, have no classical analog, and they also satisfy non-local equations of motion that explains very simply the Aronov-Bohm effect. Is that if you, because these are the operators that measure the interferences, and because their equations of motion feel the potential at different places. This is why, you know, you can have a kind of kick or force or an effect in a place where there seemingly is no derivative of the potential, because there's still a difference of potential across your medium. Okay? So this is the dynamical non-locality, which is... the reason they were not, I think, really, they're not really used in everyday, or they are not in the forefront of the way we talk about quantum mechanics, is that in some sense they are contextual. Here it involves a lens, and this lens is kind of built in the apparatus, so it doesn't seem that it has anything fundamental, and in fact, you know, this is where we're going to come back to that. So I think this is one of the very important way quantum mechanics is non-local. The other way, if we look at GR, GR is also fundamentally non-local. The main reason for that is diffeomorphism invariance. Essentially, because of diffeomorphic invariance, gravity observables are necessarily non-local. You can think of gravity as a gauge theory for which the charge is the mass, and then gravity observables are like gauge, you know, Wilson lines. And of course, Wilson lines are non-local, and then the non-locality is encoded into the constraints, like a generalized form of the Gauss law. And this is essentially this generalized form of the Gauss law, which expresses different variants that allow you to have holography. In some sense, at the kinematical level, holography for gravity is essentially a generalized Gauss constraint, which allow you to push your degrees of freedom to the boundary. Now, okay. So far, so good. But in gauge theory, we don't see what happens in the center of the sun with light for a good reason, because it's screened. Okay, gravity is fundamentally different. If we could see, if I could have goggles that see gravity light, gravity waves, I would see the universe is entirely transparent to it. That's very important to appreciate. This is why going after the detection of gravitational wave is important. Like if we could, in principle, you would see everything. The reason you see everything is that because of causality, the charge of gravity, it's the energy, and the energy is positive. So therefore, you cannot screen it. If something wiggles in the center of the sun, you know, in principle, can see it. In practice, of course, that's complicated. Now, another non-local effect, which is tied up to the presence of this gravitational generalized Gauss law, is emphasized a lot by Tuft, is the non-local memory effect, which is like if I take a particle, I boost it, and I send a shockwave through this to this room. Before the shockwave arrive, you know, it's flat. After, it's flat. So you don't really feel anything. The only thing we would see is that, you know, somehow there would be a difference between before and after. You will be all kind of shifted. You know, the closest to the particle will be dragged further away. So everybody will be shifted. They will continue to do their own stuff, right? And we will just shift it after. And what's interesting is that the shift, okay, it's proportional to the transverse distance here, but essentially it's a shift which is essentially proportional to the energy. I'm going to use that. So the non-locality of gravity is somehow a non-locality where the distance is proportional to the energy you're putting in. And this bears some resemblance with this Arnold-Bohm phase. And Tuft was, you know, the one arguing before everybody else that somehow, if you want to deal with quantum gravity, you need to kind of generalize the notion of S matrix in order to include these kind of effects in your description. Okay, so the conclusion is that both gravity and quantum mechanics leads to a new class of non-local observables. Okay, so now we have to face this question: what kind of non-locality? So what's clear? What is clear about quantum gravity? It should emerge from a theory which is quantum. And it has a fundamental delocalization scale. I'm going to argue more about that because of the nature of H bar and G. But it should satisfy the relativity principle. I'm not going to go below that. But at least I want to go back there because maybe in the construction of quantum gravity, we have put so much more other extra bells and whistles and hypotheses that I feel it's maybe the time to kind of go back to the basics. So non-locality cannot be arbitrary, and then from that perspective, for me, the main fundamental challenge of quantum gravity is to reconcile having a fundamental scale with Lorentz invariance. Okay, I'm not saying that if you do that, I want to see that realized. Whether that is going to be the quantum gravity realized in nature, maybe is there only one way to do that? I don't know, but you know, let's just focus on this simple problem.
Are you thinking the fundamental scale is the factor?
Yes, let's say. That's what I'm thinking, and I'm going to argue a bit more why I'm saying that. And this is going to be, to reveal, is essentially what I would call the quantum equivalence principle, that I want to take this scale as being real. That's going to be the main assumption there, one of the main assumptions, I mean. And the principle that, you know, I'm going to use is this idea of relative locality. That is the idea that space-time itself is a relative notion. And I'm going to explain relative to what. So this idea of relative locality comes from the idea that when you start to think about processes of localizations, you always use some kind of process of localization, sending, like, receiving, putting particles, interaction between subsystems. So in relative locality, we postulate that processes among probes define via localization their own notion of space-time. And we don't make the assumption, which is usually made, that this notion of space-time is independent of the nature of the probe. We just ask the question, well, to what extent is it, and to what extent it is not? Okay? And in that sense, locality is relative. It's relative to the quantum number of this probe. So relative locality, in some sense, you can think of it as being able to incorporate the ability to change polarizations in quantum mechanics. And it's related to the principle of bound duality, the ability to somehow describe physics in positions or momenta space, and somehow we don't lose what physics is about. And this is, in some sense, the challenge is to have such a relative notion of space-time, but preserve this bound duality as a symmetry principle. That's going to be the idea. Now, one remark here is that in any model, if I'm correct, in any model that has Lorentz invariants and a fundamental length scale, I know two, 3D gravity and string theory, then relative locality should be at play. Okay, and we are going to see whether string theory is Lorentz invariant that has a fundamental length scale. It's not the Planck length, but it's a string length. And therefore, we claim it should organize itself under the relativity principle. At least that's a kind of a theoretical test that it makes sense. So in order to understand what is relative locality, we need to understand what is absolute locality. That is, what it is. What is the assumption we're making every day when we do physics that I'm going to question? The assumption that we do when we do physics is it's absolute locality. It's the hypothesis that the concept of space-time is independent on the nature of the probe we use. It's such a common hypothesis. When you write down a field, it's out. So that's why you need to phrase first your hypothesis to say I'm a believer in absolute locality, and that's fine, but at least now you know it. Okay, so if you're not a believer, if you want to question that belief, relative locality starts as a question. Well, is it true that space-time is really an absolute notion independent of the nature of the probe? This is really where it started. And we explored this idea that space-time depends on the quantum nature of the probe used, that is the nature of energy and quantum number. If we think about it, usual space-time really comes from the notion that we are using probes which are classical and point-like. And if you use classical and point-like notion, yes, you're going to conclude that space-time is independent of the nature of the probe. So then, what is the proper notion of quantum space-time associated to quantum and non-local probe, which I'm going to use somewhat interchangeably, without really being clear on why I interchange them consistently, because I think it's part of the intuition. Now, since space-time appears, we're going to explore that, as a change of polarization in quantum mechanics, and polarization can be changed freely in quantum mechanics, then preserving this possibility, this symmetry of quantum mechanics to change polarization means that, we are forced to this notion of relative space-time. The consistency of space, the notion of space with quantum mechanics, I think this notion of relative is forced on you. And relative to what? It's relative to the, when you go from X to P, it's relative to the polarization you're rotating it. That is, the notion of space-time is relative to energy momentum space, and the bigger realm in which you can maybe talk about the symmetry principle is the thing that unify both, which is space-time and energy momentum. So, okay, but why, how to implement it, and what are the elements? Okay, so first, to get inspiration, instead of talking a lot about relative locality, let me give pictures that illustrate that. And the first is just you look at the sky. So what do you see when you look at the sky? Do you see one sky? Well, no, you don't see one sky. It depends how you look at it, right? So of course, when you look at these pictures, we have in mind, all these pictures represent one unique space-time. And then we analyze the data in the light of that hypothesis. We could do something else. We could just take the raw data and ask the question, to what extent, of course, space-time appears as subtle correlations among these different pictures taken at different energy. So we could look at the data differently and say, well, to what extent, is it true that it's exactly the same space-time that I see in these different pictures? Okay, so here maybe for that, we could argue it's big space, whether it's necessary or not. Okay, but there is an example where, in fact, you better do that. Okay, and this is due to a beautiful work by Simus Davies. Simus Davies has done a work in his lab studying quantum material. So there's a system where we know for sure that locality is relative. It's in quantum crystals. What is Simus Davies did? He looked at quantum crystals and he asked the question, can I see where the electron is localized? Okay, so he wants to see where is the electron? what is the localization property of the electron? What he does is that he takes a tunnel microscopes and he goes above one single atom at a time. And he measures, you know, the density of electrons there by measuring the tunneling current. And of course, these things depend on the knob, which is the potential you put in between. Okay, and then he goes to the next atom. And, you know, you have to be, I don't know, to imagine even setting up such an experiment, it's crazy. And he did it, okay? So this picture, each picture takes, initially, maybe a month of work, okay? It's one atom at a time. Then what do you get? You get a picture for where the electron is. But in fact, you don't get a picture, you get a movie. You get a picture for each energy, because what you're doing is that you're looking at a quantum wave function. So here, what we're looking at is a picture of a quantum wave function. But in order to see this quantum wave function, you have to set up the energy and you look at a slice of the quantum wave functions. And what do you see? Well, you see that, and this slice depends on the energy at which you put your, you know, voltage there. So you see, you know, that at low energy, you have a translation invariant vacua, like a Minkowski type of vacua, where it doesn't matter that there is a fundamental length scale in the system. Then, you know, you get to the next phase where you get, not so surprisingly, you get localizations which are really completely adapted to where the atoms are. Okay? And then if you go higher, there's a new phenomena that appears, which is the phenomena where somehow Aronoff-Bohm phase starts to dominate. And then there's another length scale which appears in the game, which has absolutely nothing to do with the size of, with the atom. This length scale is where we don't see the waves, but in Fourier transform, you see really that it's kind of waves. These are the length scale of Friedel's oscillations. Nothing to do with me, i.e. I wish they were, but I'm sorry. I mean, for me. Anyway, and then at very high energy, you get disordered. So now you can ask the question, is a quantum crystal an ordered system or disordered? It's meaningless, because it depends. It's completely ill-defined in quantum mechanics. It depends on the observation and not just the system. Okay, so in the same region of space, we can have different eigenstates of different energy. Some of them are ordered at a given energy, and some of them are disordered at another. Okay, so the physics, the reality of where the electron is in the beholder's eye. This is really what Seamus Davies' picture demonstrates absolutely clearly. Okay, it's maybe not a surprise for people who understand quantum mechanics, but it's kind of amazing to see that, I find. So the analogy we're going to have is that somehow space-time will be more like this quantum crystal as a kind of a basic idea, and then the probes we're talking about are like the electrons. Okay, so here, locality is relative. I hope I demonstrated that to you. It's an experimental evidence. But of course, relativity is missing. There's a preferred length scale. It's in a lab. Okay, so that's essentially somehow what I have in mind when I talk about relative locality. So how do we go further and how do we try to flesh it a little bit? So let's go back to this idea of unification, and because it's a relativity principle, let's try to look at the previous relativity principle, special relativity. So in special relativity, the take I'm going to say is that special relativity, the key factor is that there's a universal speed in the game, which is also understood as a unit, so it could be understood as a speed of an object, physical object, light, that's one thing, but it's also understood as some kind of universal conversion factor that affects every other object and allow me to convert space with time. Okay, and this ability to convert space with time leads to an observer-dependent notion of space-time, and their unification in a geometrical structure, which we know well, which is the Minkowski space-time. And essentially, the Minkowski metric is the metric that defines the causal structure is what we're left. The causal structure, you know, determines what is space-time like and what is space-like like. Okay, so now I want to include G Newton into the game. The standard picture of G Newton is that this is just a coupling constant. And I want to depart from that. That's going to be my, you know, where I depart from the usual picture. I don't want to view G Newton as a coupling constant. I want to view it as something more fundamental than that. And the reason for that is that in general relativity, due to the equivalence principle, G Newton, so first if you compute the dimension, Gn over C is the dimension of an inverse tension. That's a ratio of a length over an energy. Okay, and this inverse tension is universal. That's the statement of the equivalence principle. Okay, this is my take on the equivalence principle. The equivalence principle tells me that G Newton is a universal conversion factor between space and energy. If I take that seriously, then this naturally leads to the notion that we have observed, the notion of space-time is observer-dependent, and the notion of energy momentum is also observer-dependent, and we need to unify them in some kind of geometrical realm into something which is the phase space of the relativistic phase space of individual probes. So let's challenge a little bit that, because usually that's not how we see G Newton, especially at the quantum level, because at the quantum level we can say, well, G Newton runs, right? So what do we do with that? And it's true, but because G Newton is a dimensionful quantity, the fact that it runs or not is just a matter of which unit you're choosing. Okay, so you can always set up your units in terms of another dimensionful parameter and decide that you're going to work in Planck units. By doing that, what you're really doing is essentially trying to extend the notion of the equivalence principle to quantum probes. Okay, saying that this fact that G Newton is universal and fixed and can be used as a set of units, Planck units are not just classical object quantum, this is where I have this equivalence principle. So now, G Newton together with H bar gives us a fundamental length and fundamental energy scale that we can use to unify energy momenta or look at nonlinear functions of. Okay, so here I emphasize it's always a point of confusion. I'm not talking about the phase space of quantum gravity field. I'm really talking about the phase space P and Q of one, let's say, particle probe or maybe string probes, like individual probes that try to derive what the proper big thing is, the concept of space time.
Question. In quantum field theory, of course, we don't talk about particles because that's kind of the observer dependent notion. So,
yeah.
So
but in quantum field theory, where is it? You have X here, so the you cannot even question the. So X is put in, it's built on X, so I'm not going to, that's why I want to depart from quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, you're cornered in a way which is completely mathematically consistent, but it cannot talk about changing what X is by definition. So yeah, I'm not talking about fields here. That's true. I want to go beyond. I mean, at the end of the day, if what I'm saying is true, you know, I want to go beyond effective theory. That's the first challenge. If effective theory is correct, then we have a theory of quantum gravity. I need.
Do you think that fundamental space is not the space-time, but it's the space of space?
Okay, that's maybe more closer to that. It's not exactly that because phase space is too big in some sense. So we need to get half of it out, right? And that's where we're going. So okay, so here. Even if I took a very fundamental level, but that's essentially where I'm going. So now the geometry of space-time, if we follow these lines to take G Newton as conversion factor, geometry of space-time is encoded into a Lorentzian metric. And this, as I said, you know, this Lorentzian metric encodes the notion of space-like and time-like, the difference between space-like and time-like. Now, similarly, in order to make sense of what I just said, we need to include a geometrical structure on phase space that are going to encode the difference between space-time-like and energy-momentum-like, okay? And we call this geometry a bound geometry. Okay, so first, because we have a length scale and an energy scale, we can make ratio of this with the whatever we call P and Q and define dimensionless quantity. This dimensionless quantity, you know, can be unified in a big vector, so now the coordinates are in phase space. In order to do that and be non-contextual, you need to have a fundamental length scale. That was a problem of Aronoff. In some sense, Aronoff already had this, you know, things built in, but they were contextual. So the only add-on to quantum gravity is that it provides you non-contextual notion of length scale and energy scale. Okay, and they don't commute, okay? And then essentially, G Newton is the ratio and H bar is the product. Okay, so what is this bound geometry that I claim replace the that extends, it's not that it replaces, somehow extend naturally the notion of geometry, Einsteinian or Minkowskian geometry to phase space. And then we can show in what sense usual geometry is just a singular limit of that construction. So it's just a bigger geometrical setting that includes all the ideas were inspired by all the ideas I've been talking to. So phase space, I claim, possesses three natural structures. So because it's a phase space, first it possesses a symplectic structure, which is a dp dq2 form that tells us what are the conjugate variable? Okay, X and X tilde are my Darboux coordinate, they don't commute. That's usually what we think about phase space. This is the Poisson bracket, and at the quantum level, they don't. Okay, but that's not all. I claim that phase space needs to be equipped with two metrics. One, which I call the quantum metric, or I could call it the generalized metric to make a connection with other work in mathematics. And then another metric which hasn't received any attention. In some sense, it's the poor guy, and I want to bring this guy in the forefront. Okay, this is what I call the locality metric. Okay, so there's these three structures, symplectic structure and two metrics. So what are these two metrics? The first metric, let's look at this generalized metric, is somehow the natural generalization of the Minkowski metric. So Minkowski metric is the Q square, okay? Well, if you have dp square, why not, you know, assume they're orthogonal and then you can measure distance in Q or in P, okay? So in some sense, think about the notion of distance. What does it mean to be close to something? Well, you can be close in two ways. You can be close in space, but you can also be close because you are exactly in the same state. Okay, you could be at the other end of the universe. You could be but if you are the same electron, the same state, in some sense you're also close. Okay, you're far. So you're close in quantum mechanics. In fact, you know, there's this notion of that. The notion of closeness is not just necessarily measured by how close you are in space, but also how close you are in Hilbert space. Okay, so here is somehow a geometrization of that. So you think of that as being close in space and being close in phase space. Okay. So this metric is going to be—it's like a double Lorentzian metric. It's a signature, two D minus two. And if you look at, why don't we never see this when we make the transition? We don't really care about how much energy change along the way. The reason is that the conversion factor we're using is G Newton. G Newton is the inverse G Newton is a gravitational tension. It's absolutely huge. If you want to rip apart. It's if you imagine that space-time is some kind of fabric and you have to put attention to pull it apart, okay? This is 10 to the 17 kilogram per angstrom, okay? This is how much you will have to do to kind of maybe kick it pop out. Okay, so for all practical purpose, when we look at fundamental particle, you can compute this object. So here, you see that you have to compare GDP with DQ, okay? It's a sum of two terms. But one of these terms is way smaller than that. You put that for the hydrogen atom, it's 10 to the minus 50, okay? So it's just like ridiculous. So of course, for all practical purpose, we don't care. For all practical purpose, when we measure distance in phase space, it doesn't matter if the energy has changed or not along the process, okay? For the usual process we probe. So from that point of view, the metric is viewed, reduces to the usual space-time metric when space-time is viewed just as a slice of phase space. Okay, for this mechanical reason. And so in relative locality, the space-time metric is just the leftover of the quantum metric. I won't have time to explain that, but the quantum metric is directly related to the bond geometry of quantum mechanics. And essentially, in order to get back to the space-time meter, we just have to ignore energy change through motions, which doesn't cost us very much for the usual settings. Okay, so what about the third metric, the locality metric? It's a metric which is neutral. It has signature, it has as much plus as minus, so its symmetric group is ODD, if you want. And it encodes the distinction between space-time-like and energy-momentum-like. So the formula is it looks like the symplectic structure in Darboux coordinate, dp dq, but it's a symmetric form here. And essentially, the way you recognize the role of this metric is to tell you, because it's not enough to have phase space. You see, when we do physics, we don't get confused that momenta is position, where things are local in. So there's a fundamental, even if you unify this to realm, it's like there's a fundamental distinction between space and time, right? So it's not because you unify the two that you're saying they're the same thing. So here, you need a structure that tells you how much different they are, right? To be able to distinguish them. This is the role of the structure. Vector tangent to space times are null with respect to the structure, and vector tangent to momentum space also are null. So in some sense, it's kind of a causal structure in phase space that naturally tells you, splits your phase space into two Lagrangian. So this new metric captures the essence of relative locality in the following sense that if you assume that this metric is flat, you get back essentially usual absolute locality. Okay, so when you believe in absolute locality, you believe that this metric in phase space is just flat. It's God given. It doesn't move. It's non-dynamical, which is fine. But at least it phrases out a little bit the extent of your hypothesis there. So you could demand, okay, well, curving H is like putting quantum gravity. You know, what is curving eta? And we call it gravitizing the quantum. It's like the other side of it. And anyway, ultimately in this framework, it's not putting gravity and quantum. It's not like you put the quantum on top of gravity. It's like you have to put the two to bring the two together. So not only quantum affects gravity, but gravity affects the quantum too. So as I say, you know, relative locality, space-time is not an absolute notion. Here we have a mathematical expression for that. We can say space-time is a Lagrangian manifold in phase space, and which one? Of course, the one. A Lagrangian manifold is a manifold for which things commute, okay? But which one? And the one is chosen by this metric eta. Eta tells you which one you call space, okay? And in fact, it's a B Lagrangian structure. Okay, so this was a classical description. You can develop the geometry of that object. It's a very interesting mathematical subject. So far we have presented the classical side of relative locality, but now, you know, we're interested in the quantum. So now at the quantum level, the phase space is promoted to a non-commutative, let's say Heisenberg algebra for the simplest case. So let's go back to this question of space. So in quantum mechanics, how does space appear? We already talked about it. Euclidean space appears as a choice of polarization. That is, it appears in the Schrödinger representation as the argument of the wave function. And this choice of polarization is exactly the quantum analog of a choice of a Lagrangian. There's a mathematical correspondence, in some sense, between Lagrangian and polarization to some extent. Okay? And then when we go to a relativistic field, what we do is that we change the nature of the field, but we don't change the nature of the polarization. We don't touch Schrödinger polarization. The people who do quantum mechanics says that Schrödinger polarization is only one way, and if you study other systems, it might not be the best way to capture the essence of quantum mechanics. And so in Lorentzian space, you know, space appears as a field label. And classical locality is built in, you know, the definition of the field as we discussed. There. So, okay, so what would be a notion of quantum space-time if we really take this point of view that classical space is a polarization in phase space? Well, you get a natural definition. Quantum space are simply choices of polarization of the Heisenberg algebra. Okay? So you have the Heisenberg algebra, and you have a simple mathematical theorem. Question is, what are the polarization? Now, to understand polarization, we know that a choice of polarization like the Schrödinger is essentially the same as choosing a maximally commuting algebra, the functions of the operator X, and diagonalizing that. Okay, that's how we choose a polarization. And therefore, Schrödinger-like polarization is associated with functions which are functions defined only on classical Lagrangians. Okay. So by definition, we're going to take the definition that the quantum space, the most natural definition you can think, is just a commutative star subalgebra, or let's say the Heisenberg algebra. Okay, but does that give us anything more than what we know? And remarkably, yes, it does. So to simplify the problem, let's look not at the most general, like curved space, but flat case. So the notion of flat case is that I'm going to look at quantum space which are associated with abelian subgroup of the Heisenberg group. And you can easily prove that these subgroups are generated by the observable we talked about, which are the modular observables. So generically, if you ask yourself what is the commutative subalgebra of commutative subgroup of the Heisenberg group, then you'll find these are the modular observables. The paradoxical statement there is that in the quantum realm, there is more commutative direction than in the classical realm. Okay, this is why you get something new. I know it sounds very paradoxical, it goes against what you do. This is the statement. Here I'm saying, if you look at these observables, x and xt do not commute. I exponentiate them with phase 2 pi. You can do the computation, these two observables commute. Okay, classically, they don't commute. Okay? Classically, it's impossible to have a function of x that commutes with a function of xt. So these things, as this relation, it doesn't contain any H bar, has absolutely no classical analog. You can't even think of it classical. Okay? But it, it realized what I'm just saying. Maybe I'm saying in the most provocative manner to wake you up. It's the end of the talk. But it's kind of mathematically true. Okay, there's more somehow classical reality in quantum mechanics than there is in classical.
Sorry, in both senses that observable, that's not Hermitian, right? If X is Hermitian.
No, it's not Hermitian. I'm talking about the group. Yeah.
Okay, but it's not.
So the Hermitian would be the angle, but to define mathematically the angle.
Okay, so it's
like, I mean, you can make some of such observable which are Hermitian if you
cosine,
want.
Cosine would be Hermitian.
Yeah, a quotient would be Hermitian. The cosine. So I agree. It's not a problem. Cosine and sine would be Hermitian. So this modular space, because I define, this is my definition, modular space of this flat version, are quantum Lagrangian with no classical analog. What do they look like? I have phase space, and here essentially what I'm saying is that, well, you can carve a little cell in phase space, okay, with arbitrary shape, and you can locate arbitrarily precisely any point there, even if it depends on x and x tilde. So how does the uncertainty principle is realized? There's a modular version which says, okay, you can locate you arbitrarily close wherever you want there, but you don't know which cells you're in. Okay, that's the modular uncertainty principle. So it doesn't violate modular. So you can fix x and you can fix p and still respect the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, and of course, how do you recover the classical Lagrangian? You clearly see that this is a cell. It contains some flux here. It has some structure, some geometry, an area. What is the singular limit? The singular limit is you take this cell and you flatten it in the most brutal manner in one direction, and it loses all its structure, and that's classical space-time. Okay, so it's clearly in a singular limit in the Michael Berry sets. Okay? Schrödinger representation is absolutely not generic. If you pick at random a polarization of Heisenberg algebra, you will ever, never, with measure zero, find Schrödinger. Okay, you will always find these. So these are the typical quantum space. Okay, and the one we usually work with is generic because we came from a classical story. We never ask what is the quantum telling us about space. Okay, so what is the idea here? It's a very simple idea, but I think it's kind of cute or radical. Is that usually, what do we use space for? Usually we use space to determine what is the maximum sets of commuting measurements we can do to a system. Right? This is what we use space for. Things commute when they're space like this. Here, what am I doing? I'm just doing the reverse. I'm saying, no, that's not the way you should put it. You should just say exactly the inverse. You should say that it's the maximum sets of commuting observables you're choosing that defines what is space. Okay, space is, by essence, from the point of view of quantum mechanics, the maximal sets of commuting measurements you can do. And once you have that, it sets up some kind of a reality basis that is fundamentally quantum, and you're going to use, okay? So this is now my picture of space. Space is this quantum polarization. And by essence, it has all the structure one. It has a built-in length scale. It is kind of classical because everything commutes on it, so you don't see the difference. And it's fundamentally quantum because I cannot define it if I don't have the quantum. Okay, so is there, that's a very nice notion. The question is that we have an example of a physical, or let's say, mathematical system, semi like physical for high energy theorists, PI physical system, where modular space time is realized. And the claim is that, yes, in fact, this is how somehow we came across that notion, even if it has nothing to do with it, which is string theory. And we, if I have enough time, I don't know, we can show that the target space of closed string, when you take its full expression, is a relativistic version of modular space. And this notion of modularity and bound duality, which is built in, is essentially the geometrical expressions of T-duality, which was escaping for a long time a natural geometrical expression understanding. So, can
I understand something? Are you suggesting that if I move something by Planck length, then there is no physical difference between? Because that's, if you say you only see the e to the 2πix,
No, I'm not saying that there's no physical difference. I'm saying in the same way that translation, there's a state where, there could be a translation invariant state, and you can construct that object.
So if I change x by Planck by 1, then e to the 2 pi I x doesn't change, right?
Yeah, these observables are, but it's like if you change p, x doesn't change, right?
Yeah.
So it's we're talking about, yeah, we're going to go there. It's like maybe I hope I'll explain that. But it's like when you choose a polarization, you diagonalize x, You can change p. It doesn't still change the way you diagonalize x.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just thinking about either x or p individually. It looks like those what you call observables are insensitive to any multiple of Planck length. If you have shift in any multiple of Planck length.
No, because I'm going to look at the space of functions on that. Maybe. Yeah. I'm going to talk about symmetry because this is somehow one of the punchline, if I manage to get there, which is, okay, I wanted to explain to you a little bit how you, you know, what is the Hilbert space of that and why it's related to this Born geometry. So the main result is that, which you can, so all of these is just pure math now, okay? So there's no, but simple pure math, but somehow forgotten pure math. So it's generic commutative subalgebra is associated with a lattice in phase space. Okay, so you have a one-to-one correspondence between lattice and subgroup of the Heisenberg group. Okay, so this defines some kind of phase space torus. You take, you have your phase space, you quotient it by this lattice. This lattice, in order to be a formal representation, it needs to be integral with respect to a neutral metric. So this is where this locality metric appears. It's built in the choice of representation. Okay, it's also built in the locality metric, if you understand quantum mechanics. It's also built in into the choice of operator ordering. Okay, so I don't have time to explain that, but it's the key, it's a key element of quantum mechanics. And essentially, this metric has to be compatible with my symplectic structure in the sense that being null for eta has to be the same thing as being Lagrangian for omega. Okay, so because of this metric, I can somehow find a, okay, it's going to be technical, but I have my torus, I can find a U1 bundle over that torus, and to define this lift, I need eta, okay? And then the Hilbert space is the space of section above that. So there's kind of a phase. This space necessarily has this extra Aronoff-Bohm phase hanging around all the time. And in plain English, essentially what I'm saying here is that the modular wave function is just quasi-periodic. It's not exactly periodic. You know, if you translate it there, it gets a phase. If you translate it there in the other Lagrangian, it doesn't move. Which is, okay, like saying this is your statement, that it's kind of invariant, a function of x is invariant under change of p. Okay, here it's the same kind of statement. And then we have omega, which defines the quantum. We have eta, that defines the representation. Where is h? Well, h is encoded into the choice of vacua. It's encoded into what is it that I'm going to call empty space. Okay?
Why isn't that the less symmetric? But when it's shift x tilde, there is no extra phase.
It's not. That's very important. Because you want this cell is carrying an Aronoff-Bohm flux here. This is maybe what I explained here. So the quasi-periods are there because each cell, you know, carries a tail, a tail of an Aronoff-Bohm flux. And in some sense, you have to put, the commutativity forces you to put a unit flux there. I'm not claiming you should understand every detail. Just believe me for the. It would take me a talk to explain it at length, and I'd be happy to do that. But the results are pretty simple. And this representation, where was I? Okay, so you know we see that it's kind of strange because if we look at the 1D space, the 1D Euclidean space, classical, is a shrinking. So it's a one-dimensional, it's not compact, and it's simply connected. A 1D modulo space, technically, it's two dimensional, it's a torus, and it's not simply connected, and it carries flux. Okay, so a one-dimensional quantum modulo space has this kind of classical geometry, which is very different from the classical geometry you would imagine it should have. And now, essentially, you can try to understand what is the relationship between fields which are local in modular space and Schrödinger. And essentially, the relationship is the relationship between superposition. Essentially, a field local in a modular space is exactly like a particular superpositions of many delocalized Schrödinger space. And whatever is your theory of quantum gravity, at some point, it should be able to deal with the ability of superposition. Most of quantum gravity today focuses on the fact that I have a space-time. It kind of stays unique. So in the back of the mind, you imagine that you have a state which is very peaked around the classical geometry. And then you look at deformations, which are deformations of the metric. Okay, this is what 99.99% of the work on quantum gravity are about. Here I'm talking about something else. I'm not saying this is not important, but there's another part which neglected is quantum mechanics allow you to do superpositions of space-time. This is what this modular space express. Okay, it exists even if there is no curvature. Right? Usually there's this picture that quantum gravity is about, I don't know, high energy, singularity, high curvature. No, it will also allow you to superpose space-time. And bizarrely, these superpositions have, you know, they have their own notion of locality. Okay, and disappears in the literature on condensed matter when the people try to understand the block electron. It's called the Zach transform. It's a beautiful literature. Okay. As I said already, so we need this lift and the geometrical structure, eta determines the polarization. It also encodes the operator rendering ambiguity. And H determines the vacuum. So in some sense, all the choices we have to make to quantize are encoded into geometrical structure. And this is the ones that we're going to play with render dynamical in some sense. In our context today, these are kinematical structure. In quantum mechanics, they are totally kinematical. So let me take, maybe if I'm allowed to take, I started about now, if I'm allowed to take 5 minutes to more. So two things. I want to say, okay, well, the big deal was how do we reconcile discreteness and Lorentz invariance? And let me just sketch that very, very rapidly. Classically, here I've put a lattice. If you want, I've put a lattice. You think of modular space, some kind of lattice in phase space. And the lattice, you know, breaks Lorentz invariance. If you boost yourself, you're going to see the shape of the lattice change. Okay, so a priori, well, I've not achieved what I want because my torus gate changed. But that's the beauty of quantum mechanics, is that in fact, that's not the story. Classically, it is true. The symmetry is completely broken. The lattice is different, and the torus is different. There's nothing you can do. It's another one. But this is the beauty of quantum mechanics. In some sense, we already know that. We have spin. Spin is a discrete system, but it's invariant under rotation group, which is a continuous symmetry group. How is it working? Well, very simply, because here I'm saying modular space is a choice of quantum polarization. That is, I'm choosing a subgroup, which is commutative here. When I boost, or when I translate, you know, I'm going to get another subgroup, G prime, and these two groups, they don't commute. Because they don't commute, what happens? I know that there exists a reformulation of my original modular field as a linear superposition of the other field. Okay, this is how you can describe, even if the spin is a discrete quantum system, you know, and you look at it with your polarization. So let's say, think about space-time as choosing sigma x, and you're saying, no, everything is about sigma x, and I don't care about sigma y, sigma z, I want to translate everything about sigma x, and then you rotate. And then in sigma x picture, it's like, what's going on? You know, my spin is no longer discrete, now it has shrinked. Okay, but no, because when you rotate, you should go to the sigma z picture. Okay, and this is what's happening. So, essentially, yeah, I don't know. One of the punchline is that very simply, very organically, I don't have it to do anything, but there's a very natural way in which modular space contains a fundamental landscape and restores the possibility of Lorentz invariance, and it uses the basic idea about quantum mechanics there. So now, very rapidly. I say string theory is related to this idea, and it should, because I'm claiming this idea is a necessary idea whenever you have fundamental landscapes and relativity, and string theory does. So this is why we started with my collaborators, trying to see, because in the usual description of string, clearly there is not. So there was a conflict for me. But what happens is that if you look at closed string theory possesses internally two type of movers, left movers and right movers. When people usually talk about string theory or effectivity theory, they make the assumption that the left mover and the right mover sees exactly the same geometry. But from the string theory point of view, string theory is about conformal invariance. It doesn't care about whether it lives in a target or not. Okay. So then you can ask the question, okay, is there a formulation of string theory which geometrizes this idea that left movers and right movers could have different access to different geometry, just part of looking at the sets of all possible conformal deformation that you can deform your theory with. And you know, we gave a name to that object called the metastring. And essentially, we find that classically, the formulation forces the target to be a phase space with a bound geometry. Okay, and you need this data to write down the action. So you need a eta, an h, an omega. And eta and h have appeared in string theory. H is usually the dynamical object. Eta is completely kinematical, and omega is totally ignored. So now, at the quantum level, the string target that's our claim, is fundamentally non-commutative. And then you can look at the non-commutativity of the string coordinates, if you want, which now live in phase space. And there's two parts. There's a part of the zero mode. So the string is made out of somehow the anchor, which is the zero mode, and then all the string modes, which are the oscillators around, the vibration mode of the string. And they experience slightly different geometry in this, if you look at the full expression. The zero mode really sees the symplectic structure, and it needs to because it has to be anti-symmetric, whereas the oscillator, here there's some kind of theta function, a step function, which is anti-symmetric. And the oscillator sees the non-commutativity. So in string theory, we see that somehow omega is the non-commutativity and eta is a measure of non-locality. Okay, so I haven't emphasized that, but in quantum mechanics, there's this interplay between somehow being non-commutative and being non-local, and sometimes they are interchangeable, but here it's a place where it goes. So the claim is that when you look at the closed string, its off-shell formulation is really that it lives in a non-commutative phase space. And the on-shell condition and mutual locality on the worksheet imposes that the string has to propagate in a sub-commutative algebra. So it has to propagate in a relativistic version of modulo space, modulo space-time. Now, in the limit where we contract the modulo space-time to Schrödinger space-time, and we ignore the non-commutativity, we just recover the usual formulation of string. This is the same statement that you know this formulation is a singular limit of a fuller expression. Now, this type of geometry was studied before in the context of double phi theory in physics and also in the context in mathematics in generalized geometry. There's a very interesting body of work. But this generalized geometry, in fact, really corresponds to a case where you're keeping eta, this relativity metric there, but you're kind of sending the non-commutativity to zero. So it's kind of an interesting mathematical limit to look at, but it's kind of inconsistent because eta and omega talk to each other, and that explains why attempts in double phi theory to go beyond one loop never really pan out, because there's certain, as it really works out at the tree level, not beyond. But anyway, you know, the structure also appeared in an attempt to incorporate T-duality in a geometrical setting. So it's not a surprise that it appears in the fuller expression of string theory. And now we have this background, in some sense, is non-commutative. We have access to a wealth of new type of what we're called non-geometrical background. But for us, they are now just modular space-time. And an example for the specialist is called asymmetric orbifold. Okay. I'm not going to explain all the details, but the main thing is that I haven't explained that the structure group that preserve omega, eta, and h is the Lorentz group. Okay, so this is where Lorentz symmetry comes up. It's the intersection of the symplectic group, orthogonal group, and doubly orthogonal group. This is Lorentz. It's the day I saw this formula, I was, it's the cutest way to see Lorentz appearing. Of course, I put it from. Anyway, it turns out Lorentz preserved this three structure. That's the thing. Okay, here is the conclusion. So we have reviewed the concept of space and time and proposed a new notion of space, you know, which is fundamentally quantum, fundamentally non-local, and respecting this principle of relative locality, which, you know, is yet to be fully formulated. I'm not claiming that, you know, everything is written in stone here. But the key idea is that, you know, this principle and this idea gives us one example, where we can reconcile organically discreteness and relativity. And it appears in its fullest expression in some version of string theory. So that gives us confirmations or you know, gives us models where we can probe it, in some sense, deform it. There's many things we haven't discussed. I talked a lot about space. What about time? You know, there are lots of discussions in the literature about how we change space, but it's all in the context of usual quantum mechanics where time is sacred. But the principle of relativity says, well, if you start to play with space, you know, not soon enough, you have to face the consequence that you have to play with time too, and that's very painful. Okay, but there's no other way. Or you do what Ojava is doing. You just say, well, no, you know, I treat them differently. That's the only two options, in my view. But I understand. It's okay. So you know, it means that the notion of causality itself has to be reformulated. Maybe this is going to be the deepest expression of what I mean by relative locality. And of course, what I need is also a notion of concept of field. We talked about that. You know, what is the field theory that describes, let's say, the effective descriptions of this non-commutative string? Or, you know, and then also, well, it was very flat, what I described. It was very kinematical. I'm like Euclidean, you know, a Minkowskian at best. But how do you curve these things? Is there structure equations? What is the principle that generalizes Einstein equations? All these questions are is really only the beginning, right? Now, I go back to the main theme is that the theory of quantum gravity should tell you there exist new invisibles. I'm not claiming here, I'm telling you there's new invisible, but I hope I tell you that, I don't have a quantitative description, but it's clear that there's some kind of new invisibles in the sense that usual description is a single limit. So I have a kind of qualitative description of what are these invisibles. These invisibles, if that idea is correct, is that there should be fundamental correlation between infrared and UV physics. This is inescapable. This follows from this reconciliation. And it's either there, and of course, fundamental UV-IR mixing is a no for effectivity theory. It means it's a total violation of effectivity theory, which is fine with me, because this is what I was looking for. Okay, but it definitely goes beyond effectivity theory, but of course, you know, this is the challenge. I think the things that quantum gravity requires is to question the mere things we're all standing on, which is separation of scale. The infinitely small is different from the infinitely big. It's so obviously true. How can you even question that? Thank you.
Don't
tell me it's so clear, and it all makes yes.
Double there's lectures. Sorry? Double lectures, if no
question.
Oh no. Okay. Yeah.
Einstein's relativity treats time and space in the same way, so relative locality. Is a notion in the space, and will it have a consequence of a discreteness, relative discreteness in the time direction?
Yeah, it has to. It has to, and that's the most scary of all. Like it has to. Of course, time is different than the quantum because, in some sense, space commutes and time doesn't commute. So there's kind of qualitative difference. But whatever, you know, if I follow this line of logic that I've exposed, there's no other choice. Mm. Which means you have to question the mere notion of what causality is. And if you think about it, causality is what organizes how we talk about the state of now and the state of prediction. So yes, that and there, you're welcome. You know, like, I don't think anybody, I can give you the number of papers written on that. You know, it's just maybe there's some old paper by Finkelstein. But this is, yes, this is the big challenge. And maybe this is why quantum gravity is hard, not because it's technically complicated, maybe because it forces us to ask the question you're asking. And that's, just continue to ask it, you'll see. You know, play with it. You see how it feels.
So even at the level of just the modular quantum mechanics to define modular space that you've been dealing with, have you thought about dynamics, like having some Schrodinger equation or some potential?
Yeah. So to be complete, you need to be able to understand that the Schrödinger quantum mechanic versions or the relativistic version. So far, I only have the clues that string theory gives me. Okay. So somehow, when I do the usual trick of string theory or propagating, I get the equations, but I have no idea what's the organizing principle. This is why I'm saying relative locality is not yet at its fullest because. You know, I don't know yet if these equations are the only possible ones or if there is a kind of geometrical principle behind it. But there should be. I think it's tied up with these questions of time. Now, how do you, asking the question of time without asking the question of dynamics is empty, right? So these are, excellently, this is the frontier, let's say, of this research program, one of the frontier here. All these questions are very good.
So can you describe some sort of concrete analog of the Aronoff-Bohm effect, which measures the sort of probes, there's modular variables in standard quantum case. Is there some concrete experiment you can describe that you look at modular space in your context?
I feel there should be. I haven't thought too much about interference experiment, which might be a good place to look. I looked a lot about what people say is about the quantum Hall effects. That is, how does quantum excitations in a quantum Hall samples really probe its environment? And so I've been thinking, and in that context, I feel that, so there's a feeling when you look at the literature on the quantum Hall effects and the notion of quasi particles, for instance, that maybe it's going to give us a new picture of that. For the following reason, is that it's clear that the quantum particle, from the point of view of the lab, because it's an absolutely non-local object. But on the other hand, you know, we have gathered in other evidence, let's say you look at the nu equal 1/2 point, it's a free fermion. So it's a Dirac fermion. You know, it looks like it's local in some way. Okay, so it's kind of, for me, it's kind of telling me that there's maybe a way to look at quantum mechanics where some of the paradox of quantum mechanics, they look very non-local, but it's because you're forcing a classical lecture, which is not where the system is, right? So if you allow yourself, so I would expect that, but this is more a dream and to be developed, is that most of the, let's say lots of the paradox in quantum mechanics, which look non-local, in fact, secretly they are local in a modular sense. And suddenly, it's not that quantum mechanics violate locality, it's just that quantum mechanics respects a more general form of locality. Does that, and quasi-particle would be a science now. I'm happy to start a discussion on that, I think.
I want to know where you place the boxes and how you set the experiment up.
But I want to know that too. That is. Look. The question I'm having here is I'm having the inverse problem of most people with quantum mechanics. Most people think, okay, I have classical reality and quantum mechanics is weird. For me, my problem is that quantum mechanics is perfectly fine. Classical reality is weird. How does it appear, right? Why classical reality here? It's a model. It's kind of a flattening of one representation in one direction. How does that happen? Of course, we have a process of extensification. We said that this flattening is related to the number of quanta, you know. But how do you that's my problem. It's not so. I want to know how the classical box arise, or the, you know, from the quantum. That's the quantum classical is weird from that point of view.
You might have said this, but I didn't notice that when you start talking about these modular. This torus, essentially, in phase space. These things are things that, you know, have volume H bar or something like that.
Yeah.
Where does G appear there? Because you started off saying there's a G in one of the metrics, which is the G Newton, and then somehow I didn't.
Yeah. So the total area is purely quantum, but G appears in somehow the shape. So when I was saying that the gravitational tension is huge, what I mean is that, you know, this is like the this is in Planck unit, if you want, okay? But if I look at this shape in a realistic unit, you know, I don't know. It's just I could go on for, you know, I have to do 10 to the 30 times the around the Earth, in something like that. So this is where G appears. It appears in the shape of the cell. Does that?
I thought only H bar would appear, not G as well.
That's no, because you see, there's lambda and epsilon. So G is lambda over epsilon, if you want. That determines your. Let's say you work in physical in Munich of today. Okay, then you can ask, well, what is the shape of my fundamental cell? Okay.
So lambda is Planck length and epsilon is Planck energy.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the extra, and that's for that you need to have a notion of distinguishing that direction from that direction, and that's why you need extra geometrical structure. Okay, so if you just have a quantum. That's maybe if you just have quantum, you cannot. Okay, but this extra geometrical structure, they are exactly there to give you at least some geometrical background for how G Newton enters. Now, what I haven't shown you is how this idea that G Newton is a conversion factor, which is for me the same thing as the quantum equivalence principle, leads to G Newton being, you know, a force. Okay, that's some other challenge. And that's what I'm talking about when I say gravitizing the quantum. It's at some point, you need to be able to understand, if that's correct, you need to be able to understand gravity as just kind of fiddling with quantum mechanics from that perspective. That's another challenge.
One last question.
Well, it's going to be a comment and then a question. If I can sneak them both in. But the comment is, I very much agree that non-locality is somehow key, and we should see something like a UVIR mixing. I just wanted to give an example in causal sets, an example of that kind of mixing, which comes out of the same basic relationships you talked about, is that a maximum boost, if you ask what is the largest possible Lorentz boost, it's actually controlled by something like the Hubble length, something like an infrared, arguably cosmological constant. Mm-hmm. It is another example, but that's another story. Then I had a question, which is, you told us that of course it's true, that we can do quantum mechanics with any maximally commuting set of observables. We could define a wave function based on the space of eigenvalues of any maximally commuting set of observables. So have you ever looked at just ordinary quantum mechanics? Say you wanted to do the hydrogen atom or the harmonic oscillator using your modular representation instead of the usual Schrodinger representation. Do you have an idea what it would look like? Could this be a chapter in someday?
For some it looks, that's a good question. I think it's related to the question of Lucien there, that there may be, you know, physical systems where non-locality is at play, where it looks, my intuitions are going to look drastically different. Okay, so like, because if you put a classical reading on it, you're going to tell a completely different story, which amounts to the same thing, right? And it would be nice to have I haven't played, in fact, this idea of modular space is very recent. And we went back from, you know, doing, I don't know, a normalization group of chiral string to something very elementary, like XP equal I. So I'm back down there, like questioning, you know, flat space. I think that's a good suggestion too. And for your remark, it would be true that this is a consequence, but it would be, I think, part of understanding quantum gravity would be, can we understand more rapidly, more directly, like we understand relativity, why, you know, this connection between fundamental lens, quantum relativity leads to infrared UV mixing? You know, is that inevitable? I claim it is, it's an intuition, you claim to, but, you know, in what sense? Because this is where, in my view, we're going to get the invisible. Like looking at data and you know, usually the way we look at data, that we look at it separately, different scale, because they are not correlated. But now suppose you have data where you carefully have the prediction that some fluctuations which are infrared are in fact exactly proportional to some UV fluctuation. Okay? No experimenter today looks at that, at the data like that. This would be crazy. Okay? Because and they would not know how to look. So, you know, I think that's our job of theorists and I think maybe this is why we don't discover quantum gravity, is that if we knew where to look, it would be obvious. At least that's how I hope it's going to happen in the near future.
Okay, maybe even the time.
Yeah.
Postpone questions. You can find Laurent, the localized. So,